Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Julie Olson. Julie has been assisting victims of domestic violence and abuse for 30 years. 26 of those years have been as executive director of Garfield County's Advocate Safe House. And a warning, we will be discussing abuse and violence that may trigger some listeners. Please be advised. Julie Olson, thanks for joining me for Immigrant Stories. I'd like to talk to you about Advocate Safe House, but before we do that, let's talk about you a little bit. I want to know about your journey and where you grew up and how you started. What was growing up for you?
Well, I grew up in, I consider it central Minnesota, but if you're in Minnesota, other people would consider it northern Minnesota. It's a small town about the size of Glenwood, Detroit Lakes, which is about 40 miles east of Fargo, North Dakota. Wow. So in Fargo, there are no, there's no water, meaning lakes, where as soon as you cross over into Minnesota from the Red River, there's lakes, more trees, it's green, et cetera. So we lived in lake country, the youngest of 10. So in
the
another
youngest of 10, well, you had older siblings that were more like your parents, right? You know, 10 years, well, more than 10 years difference.
The age span is 14 years between the oldest and myself. And so, yes, I would agree with that. My closest sibling today is my sister, who is 13 years older. She's the second oldest. And we kind of jokingly say that, well, you took care of me when I was a baby. And I say, I will take care of you as you age. So as a trade-off, I guess.
There's
but anyway,
the deal.
I'm very close.
Yeah. So you told me a story about your grandfather. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I found out more information. So my grandfather was born in 1891.
Okay.
And he was the youngest of, now I can't find it. I want to say like 10, 12 children. He was born in July of 1891. Typhoid fever hit their family. And the first sibling died in December of 1891. And in 3 to 4 months, there were 8 family members that died, including his mother.
Wow.
So I thought it was his father too, but it wasn't. His father died when my grandfather was 8. So not during the typhoid. And so, which is interesting because it's kind of parallels a little bit what's going on today.
Yeah,
somewhat.
I bet you've thought about him a few times.
One thing that was positive of all this was that when my grandfather's family, siblings and mother were dying, it became apparent to the community that they needed a real doctor. Prior to that, they just had a horse doctor in the area because this was rural. This was very rural Minnesota. And they figured it out and apparently got a real doctor to come to the area after that.
Whoa. So life was good for you growing up? Was it? Being one of 10, were there hard times?
You know, it's interesting. You say it like that, and I'm sure there were, but we didn't experience them. Some of the things, my husband is an only child, so he kind of kids me like, oh, you're the youngest, you got everything. And some siblings and people might think of that, and I'm like, okay, let's take a pie. And those
Yeah, let's remember 10. 10
yeah.
people.
Right. And now there's 12 with my parents. So now you divide a pie and 12 pieces. You think I got the largest? I don't think so. You know?
Yeah.
So my husband remembers once he was able to eat the pie all by himself. And I was like, no.
Well, so, and you know, that's kind of a sign of good parents when, you know, I'm sure there were hard times, but your parents being good parents sort of protected you from that and made childhood all right.
You know, it was, I think Christmas was always real magical in that it looked like, I mean, we did. We had maybe not a million, I'm exaggerating, but a ton of presents under the Christmas tree. But those are the days when, you know, Christmas, you got socks, underwear,
right,
pajamas, clothes, etc. So every piece of article of clothing was wrapped individually. So it looked like you got a ton of things, but Maybe
well,
not.
When you grow up in scarcity, you're thankful for the orange, you know? The oranges at Christmas used to be a big deal, as I remember.
Yeah. You know, we didn't have Christmas stockings, so no, we didn't do that. So, but no, I didn't feel like we were different or, you know, pretty much the whole neighborhood was the same, so it just felt the same.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. Julie Olson, Executive Director of Advocate Safe House, is my guest. And a warning, we will be discussing domestic violence and abuse. Please be advised. Well, you spent nearly 30 years assisting people who have been victimized by domestic abuse or violence.
Mm-hmm.
How did your early life influence that decision?
Well, when I think back, there wasn't any violence with my parents between each other. I don't recall that. There was, if you're 10 siblings, you're going to be pounding on each other at one time.
Yeah, we had a lot of that at my house.
Yeah, you just do and whatever. So I didn't really see that so much, but I have always felt that as a child, girls and boys should be fair. And sometimes things weren't fair. And that just riles me. And so that's where I started to come up with, I think, becoming who I am. And in an abusive relationship, it's not fair. You know, there's that level of the fair is gone. The fairness is gone. So there's that piece. I am a survivor of sexual assault my freshman year in college. And I think that's very common for many young women, or for many women for that matter. In fact, if we were to sit down with a group of women that felt comfortable disclosing and being vulnerable, telling their stories, I would say at least a quarter, if not a half of the women will say they have been victimized at some level, maybe not to the extreme of penetration, rape, but it would be maybe touching, harassment.
Yeah. Where no didn't mean no. Yeah. Right. I mean, women were subjected to, you really mean yes, so I'm not going to stop.
I see that. And to be honest, you know, that was definitely very common growing up, but I would say it's still true today. That has not changed. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. You know, there's some folks make a distinction between abuse and violence. Violence to me seems like the end of the spectrum, but there's all those things that happened before. Can you talk about the coercive sort of steps towards what is ultimately violence?
Well, you know, that's really important. It's a good distinction because some people will say, well, I wasn't hit. And I'm like, so I wasn't strangled. So I wasn't raped. And I'm like, so it'll be like, what was said to you? Because what happens in normally like in an abusive relationship, one where there is, you've been intimate with someone. So it's maybe your husband, your boyfriend, and I'm speaking in male, female terms.
Right.
And I need to distinguish that out of coercive controlling couples, approximately 85% of the victims will be female. When there's other types of, and there's certainly other types of couples that there isn't the coercive control, but they may be somewhat abusive and it may be just, and I say just, but verbal. But there isn't a pattern of power and control. That's a big key there. There isn't a pattern of power and control. Then it's more 50-50, you know, and we've all probably been there at one time or another in our relationships that we got really frustrated and we said, you know?
Right.
Now, was I trying to gain power and control? And the answer was no. So, but let's go back to that other couple where there's coercive controlling patterns. So normally what happens is that let's say I'm the abuser. I am going to start very slowly, probably saying some things to you like, are you wearing that? Just like that.
Yeah.
You said that to that person? Oh my gosh. So eventually what starts to happen as I increase that kind of verbiage, my victim or my victim will start to question what they're thinking, what they're saying. Is it okay? Is it not? So it's slow. It often happens very slow. So it's a slow process, or in the self-esteem starts to get worn down. The confidence starts to get worn down. That's what I see, like not being able to make a decision. And I've seen very strong, competent women, and then they become, they're in this relationship and they can't decide how to do anything. And I'm like, you're really smart. You know these things. But they start questioning everything about themselves.
Well, and maybe it's a web though, right? I mean, it is grooming, and it starts very subtly, and the person, the predator, starts to not want you to see other people. There's isolation.
Yes. So that's what starts to happen. There's isolation. So perhaps, you know, COVID has been horrible in regards to that, because now with COVID, for at least early on, you perhaps weren't even able to get away from your abuser. You were in the same home as your abuser at all times. Maybe you were working side by side. So you couldn't even get a break.
So no relief. Yeah.
No relief. You couldn't call someone for like just to talk with having some confidence that it was going to be private, because chances are it's not. And in a lot of cases, even, and we know this, either cell phones, emails, they're not safe necessarily. It's not a safe way to communicate. So it's really hard with cell phones today, because if someone takes your cell phone, they can look at what's the history. So it's important to either, if you can, erase it, you know, delete it, and or get one of those cheap phones at Walmart that, you know, can't be tracked. You know, I hate to say it like that, but then that leaves you know, you're safe. But the other things too, it's isolation. It's can be just also using what we call male privilege, saying like, I'm the man of the house. What I say, I'm right, you're wrong. As well as threats. I'm going to hurt your family, going to hurt your children, hurt your pets, hurt the things that you love. Let's say you have an heirloom piece of furniture from your side of the family and it's destroyed. But the one thing that we see a lot here is financial abuse, a lot of financial abuse. Because think about it. Right now, I'm thinking off the top of my head, a 2-bedroom apartment for rent in Glenwood is probably going to go between $1,500 and $2,000.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money to come up with, you know, so, and, or the fact that, so if I want to get on, leave and I'm going to be on my own, but I want to stay in the Glenwood area, that may cause some issues, financial issues.
And women without access to finances are pretty much trapped.
Yeah. And that's what we see. So one of the programs that we have is, it's new the last couple of years, it's called the Housing First Program. And we're able to help with housing for a period of time, not forever.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories Program. Julie Olson, Executive Director of Advocate Safe House, is my guest. And a warning, we're discussing domestic abuse and violence. Please be advised. We have been discussing the coercive use of isolation that a perpetrator uses in an abusive relationship.
Not long-term, meaning a year or whatever, but we might be able to help with a deposit, help with a couple months of rent to get out on your own until you're able to stabilize. But most people aren't living in Glenwood Springs. Just saying.
Our working class lives down valley. What has it done to the immigrant community? Because immigrant women are already isolated. You know, they have to worry about their status. So
that can be used against them. I was going to say, if let's say their perpetrator is either a citizen or has a green card or has access for them to gain their green card, that can be used against them definitely. And going, I will pull that up. I won't be cooperative, you know? But there are ways with U visas and stuff like that, but you need an attorney to make that happen. Mm-hmm. That's the reality. And there are great attorneys locally to help that. But I'm just saying it's not an easy journey by any means.
Yeah. A lot of folks think that abuse and violence is restricted to poor people. That's been our bias for a while. Can you dispel that?
what we tend to see here at the Safe House, at Advocate Safe House Project, is we tend to see those are either middle class or lower working class. And the reason for that is for those that are at a higher economic level, they have means, financial means, to do other things at times, but not always. I'm just saying they have a means to, I need to take a break, I'm going to go on a quick vacation. I have a means to get an attorney. I have a means to get a therapist, et cetera. I can take a break. But that's not always the case. There's also a web there as well.
Right.
With isolation, perhaps, and the threat of losing a level of status, if status is important to you. And for some people, it will be. And for some, it'll be like, it's not worth my freedom. So we, as I mentioned, we tend to see those that are making lesser money than those that are making more money. But that doesn't mean that it's not happening at the higher, you know, folks making more money.
Yeah, I think the Me Too movement has helped us see, you know, women of privilege, actresses and business business women who talk about being entrapped.
Yeah.
And being subjected to just the very things that you've talked about.
Yeah.
You know, restricting their finances, putting them down, stopping them from seeing friends, scaring them, threatening to reveal private things about them, and on and on.
Well, and I think especially with younger people today versus perhaps our generation, Walter, is that sexting is really, I think, more common.
Yes.
So you might be taking a picture of body parts, et cetera, and sending it to your beloved, but do you know that it may be go beyond that?
Yeah.
Because has caused a lot of strife for a lot of people. In fact, over the years, I know of some victims who have committed suicide over it. So,
yeah, sexual coercion is another where, you know, you're made to feel like you're not with it or whatever, and you're being asked to do things that you don't really feel comfortable or want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, you know, that going back to, I was going to say that, yes, if someone hits me, I know it's violence. I know it's abuse. But sometimes we live in a very abusive society. We live in a very verbally abusive society right now.
Yeah.
That we call each other names, we put each other down. You see it on Facebook, you social media, you see it politically. In we've seen it for the last 4 years. I'm just saying it's just out there. And so the thing is that it's really hard to go and think about, is that normal? Is that abusive? Is that healthy? Is it unhealthy? And so I look at relationships on a continuum from healthy, like uber perfect healthy, to all the extreme, to the other side.
Yeah.
Being totally unhealthy. And most of ours fall in between somewhere, you know, but hopefully towards more of the healthy side. But my sense is if you are really exhibiting unhealthy behaviors in other parts of your life, chances are they're going to be in your intimate life as well.
Well, yeah, bullying, you know,
yes.
In school, a lot of the same sort of characteristics where, oh, I thought you were my friend, you like me, and now you're saying things and you're talking about me to others, you're turning the other people against me. I mean,
well, I was going to say, and depending upon the extreme of the bully, we've had it here. Is death. We've had murderers here.
Yeah.
We do know if we look back that there was this, you know, there were protection orders. There was a criminal case or whatever. She did reach out to her family, friends. So yes, it was domestic violence.
How has your nearly 30 years doing this work, how has it affected your attitude towards men? I mean, it must be hard to, you know, you started by talking about how it isn't fair and damn, it's not fair. And how you see it in a way every day that other members of the community don't. And it's not only not fair, it's just awful. How do you stay positive about life and relationships with men and still have your trust?
Well, I think when I look back, the first training that I went to regarding domestic violence, sexual assault, you're right. I started to look at everything a little bit darker and start questioning a lot more. I'm trying to think. Yes, I was married at that time. Okay, I had to think back to when I first started. So I was married at the time and kind of looking at my relationship, my husband's relationship, questioning everything. But then it was like, oh, no, we do have a healthy relationship. You know, do we have it? Is it 100%? No, because no one is 100%. Right. You know, we're normal people. We have issues, but we deal with them directly, or if not directly, fairly directly, you know, meaning that, once again, we're not perfect. So one of the things we do is we work on our communication skills, work on having fun together, work on listening to each other. And at times, we all know that's not easy to do for lots of different reasons, because there's a lot of other stressors in our life. So that was part of it. So there was kind of this like, oh my gosh. And so I do warn people when they go through our training to be kind of prepared. You might start to question some things. Yeah. But we've also found out from people that some people who have gone through the training went, uh-oh, my relationship is not a healthy one. Uh-oh, what am I going to do about it? And I'm like, that's up to you.
So they've seen in the training, they see some of these early signs of coercive behavior that that lead ultimately to, or can lead to, abuse?
Yes. So it's just very interesting. But kind of speeding up with that, like, okay, because we could talk about that forever. But one of the things I think it's really important that kept me kind of going as long as I have is I have relationships outside of my husband. I think it's really important not to base your whole life on one relationship. Right. Meaning, I have relationships with my family members, siblings. I have girlfriends that without my girlfriends, I would be in deep doo-doo. I love them. We do things together. We are what we call ourselves Wonder Women. So we, you know, we go out, we walk, we hike, snowshoe, et cetera. The other thing is, I think it's really important to, for here at work, is to have challenges. And by challenges, I mean not just hard challenges that really go to the core all the time. But I think for me, because I've been here at this Advocate Safe House project for 26 years now, is that if this was the same job that it was 26 years ago, I would be totally bored. I would be long gone. It's not. It's evolved. It's changed. And remember, do you remember earlier when I mentioned life is like a journey? It is a journey and there is no destination. It's the same thing. And that's how I feel like now here at Advocate Safe House Project, we've been working on DEI issues for the last 4 to 5 years.
DEI is?
Diversity, equity, and inclusivity. Huh. So we've been working on it. And people say, well, what does that mean, working on it? Well, it's looking at our programs, looking at how we, policies, looking at, are we being inclusive? Is it equitable, et cetera? But also most of the work is internal work, meaning I'm working on Julie because it's easy. If I'm tired, it's really easy for me to keep my older white woman, you know, lenses on at all times with privilege. And I have privilege.
Yeah.
I'm educated. So I have a lot of privilege versus going, okay, let's take those lenses off and put some other ones on. And sometimes that's really hard, but it's really important. It's not only important for me as a person, but our organization. So I feel really blessed to be part of an organization that is open to working on those issues versus saying, they're hard, so we don't want to deal with it. But life is.
Yeah, that's the essence of white privilege. We don't want to, and we don't have to. But it's liberating to, like you say, to put a different lens on and see the world from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Because it makes you richer.
It does. And it also makes it like, what else can we be doing that would make it better for others?
Yeah.
Because I, you know, when I, 26 years ago, if we were doing what we were doing then, now, I would be very disappointed. I would hope that our organization has had evolved, and I'd like to think we have. There's things that we do now that we never even thought about doing back then.
That was Julie Olson, Executive Director of Garfield County's Advocate Safe House program. If you or someone you know is being subjected to coercive, abusive, or violent behavior, call the Advocate Safe House program's 24-hour helpline at 970-945-4439 or 970-285-0209. Those numbers again are 970-945-4439 or 970-285-0209. Thanks to Julie Olson and people like her who are busy helping victims of domestic abuse survive and ultimately thrive. You've been listening to the Immigrant Stories program. For more on immigrant stories, go to our website, immigrantstories.net, or subscribe online wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.